When it comes to weight management, we tend to focus on what we eat, but Noom's approach puts the focus on why we eat. That's a game changer. Noom uses science and personalization to help you manage your weight for the long term. Their psychology-based approach helps build better habits and behaviors that are easier to maintain. The best part? You decide how Noom fits into your life, not the other way around. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com to sign up today.
Before we get started with this episode of Bench with Bubba, I want to talk about rotoballer.com. If you guys know me by now, you've listened long enough, you know I have my written content for DFS and other season-long fantasy products over at rotoballer.com. And if you're still grinding along in the NFL streets, season-long playoffs, DFS for the NFL, don't wait any longer. Go to rotoballer.com, get the NFL Premium Pass. Are you ready to dominate your season-long in DFS leagues? Rotoballer's NFL Premium Pass includes lineup tools, projections, and DFS cheat sheets for all formats. Get access to exclusive articles, DFS tools, lineup optimizers, and premium Slack chat rooms. I do the weekly DFS cash game values, even then this Saturday even, doing some extra previews for the week's DFS slates. Come check all that out and join in on the winning and take 50% off any premium pass, not just football. If you want basketball, baseball's coming up, all that good stuff. 50% off any premium pass. Use my promo code Bubba, B-U-B-B-A, for another 10% off. So you get 60% off a premium pass. It's that simple. So get in, get ready, finish the NFL season in a strong, strong way with rotoballer.com, NFL Premium Pass. Already at 50% off now. Use promo code Bubba, B-U-B-B-A, for another 10% off when you purchase. Just visit rotoballer.com/radio, sign up today, and start rotoballing like a boss. Back everybody to another episode of Bench with Bubba, episode 433. A special guest joining me tonight, first time on the show, NFBC veteran. Most in the NFBC streets know who he is. You can find him on Twitter at Wagner13454. Dusty Wagner, how we doing, man?
Pretty good. What's up, Bubba?
Not much. Appreciate you joining me as we get ramping up here in the fantasy baseball draft season. How is draft prep going for you?
Pretty good. I think I'm like 9 DCs in. I'm just kind of starting my foray into the 12s. Just started last night, but I'm doing 20 of those this year. The most I've ever done. I'm sure I'll hate myself on Sundays, but it's a test that I needed to do for myself. So it's the prep's going good.
Are you doing 20 of the 12s or 20 DCs total?
So I'm doing 9 DCs and 20 OCs, and then both diamonds, the platinum and main events come March. So
that's a lot of fabbing. It's a lot of fabbing going on.
It's a lot of work.
Well, with what's the most you've done prior to this?
For fab leagues, probably around like 10 or 11. I try to keep it around there, just especially with being in the higher stakes leagues. The fab is just way longer if you look at more of the teams other than yourself. So like that takes more time, and it's a little bit more stringent on fab process than like a 12 or something like that, where you can kind of look over and just be concerned with your team and move on, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's such a different animal, the 12 versus the 15, that really changes things up for sure. So that will make it quite interesting. So let's look back a little bit on 2021 before we get too far into 2022, because some things like most players, good players do, they learn kind of what went right, what went wrong, and how to adjust for the next year, obviously. And what are some of the things that maybe you picked up on last year that stood out to, like, maybe you got to tweak a little bit more, or something that you like figured out ahead of time and it worked pretty well? Like what stood out to you last year?
I mean, I've kind of thought this for a while, and it, you know, I kind of did some more research on it on some of the top teams, and especially in 12s a little bit more maybe than 15s, which I think, you know, the top players in 15s take more of the safer approach in drafts. I think in 12 specifically, I'm going to reach a little bit more for the guys that get hurt, but like once they get hurt, they get hurt, like not tweaked and they miss a couple games. It's like the Justin Turners of the world, the Donaldsons, the Trouts, you know, like when they get hurt, like they're out, you can drop them, move on from the roster spot, like, and don't even have to be concerned about, oh, well, now I got to sit him on the bench or like, is he going to come back, you know? So like, I think for 12 specifically, it's just trying to be more aggressive on maybe those injury stigma type players, knowing that Fab is a little bit more involved, I think, in this game than it maybe it was in the past. I mean, it always has been a huge, huge thing. But I think now it's like, you really can start to see like some of the better teams of like, you churn really, really much. And like Chad Schrader went before he kind of quit fantasy baseball, like he dominated 12s. And the number one thing he did was like turn over a third of his roster every single week. And it's just not having those ties to players / kind of drafting your team, knowing you're going to do that. And again, like, you know, he's got other different things. It's not just that, but like, that helps a lot, like just knowing before a draft, like, okay, this is my strategy that I'm going to do for Fab. This is kind of what I've learned from looking at the top teams in 12s. You know, I'll say right now, like, I'm not really a 12-team guy. I'm more of a 15 team. That's more my foray. But more of them, more of the great players in 12s, I think, churn a lot more than a lot of us think we should.
Yeah, and it really makes sense because, A, 12s, you can – there's usually more of a something to churn with on the waiver wire compared to a 15, where it's like, at least on a 12, you can kind of paint the picture where these moves are going to pay off. Or a 15, you're just praying the guy plays most of the week type situation and gets you at bats. And that's what makes it interesting. But it's something you said, it's like not having that attachment to a player or something, because we're all so guilty of it. It's like, oh no, he's going to bounce back. Or you mentioned like the injury thing. Oh, it's just a, you know, he'll be back in 10 days and it turns into 3 weeks to 4 weeks. And now you just wasted all this time when you could have picked up so-and-so. So that's a tough thing. How have you kind of learned to know when to move on from someone?
Again, it's a little bit different in 12 and 15. 15s, you have to be a little bit more patient just because the player pool. But 12s, I think, honestly, like unless they're like your top 7-round picks, I mean, you have to be ready to move on. I know that's like a weird thing to say. And again, it's just, every injury is different, but like if a guy is going to be out a month or if it's an unknown timetable, it's like, I think I might just cut bait at this point. That's a strategy I'm going to go with. It could easily just blow up in my face, but like, I think churning the roster spots is far more valuable and giving yourself options in like 12 than it is maybe 15.
Now you said Fab is becoming more of an important game. And a lot of that is probably churning and burning. It's probably because there's more, I guess, platooning in baseball than before. So it's not like there's not as many like dead set. These guys are playing 6 to 7 days a week. You got a lot of, you know, like especially if like the Friday to Saturdays or Friday to Sundays, you can kind of mix and match things on Fab. Are you seeing that kind of be the case? It's more of a hitter's Fab thing. Are you seeing pitchers get equally, you know, with all these, you know, chances at relievers and stuff these days? How do you see the Fab churning? Is it more hitters, pitchers, or kind of a little bit of both?
I mean, it is both. Pitchers are a little bit more riskier, even in 12s. One thing I did notice, though, in some of the top teams last year is, like, a lot of those top teams maybe got an ace, but a lot of them faded pitching, but, like, kind of hit pitching in those middle rounds. Because, again, you know, like, even if you pick up a double starter and a 12, like, you're still – they're better than 15s, but they're by no means like must start, and they're very fringy or you're taking a chance or whatever. But at the same point in time, just K's and the chances for wins in 12s, I think are equally important versus like the ERA whip. So, you know, like, and with the hitters, like you mentioned, like the platoons and stuff like that, like it's all about at bats. You know, Jeff Zimmerman, I think preaches that, like he's very just volume based and, I mean, he's right, you know, but I mean, you have to be smart with it too. You know, you can't just drop, you know, one of your top hitters just because he's got a two game week too. So, but that's again, why I'm trying to be more aggressive on like, okay, well, if this guy's not going to help me again in the next month in a 12 teamer, like I might just drop it because like, again, that's a month that I could have roster flexibility on maybe four or five guys that could help me. And I think that makes a difference over time.
Yeah, roster flexibility is huge, and a lot of people like associate roster flexibility with multi-position eligibility. Is that something that you kind of focus on more with all this ever-changing platoon situation, or is that just kind of a, you know, it is what it is, and you're more just worried about making moves like, hey, these guys are in Coors this weekend type situation?
Yeah, I'm more of the hitter atmosphere, the team, like, you know, are they playing the Orioles, you know, like pitching staffs and stuff like that. You know, I've never been a multi-positional eligibility. I don't bump them up or whatever. Like, yeah, if I do like the player, it's nice. But, like, I think that's more like a DC concept. You know, it helps in 15-team leagues as well. But, like, 12, I think there's just so much of hitters out there, especially, like, in platoon situations where, like, you don't really need to be that much concerned about it. But, like, that's just my opinion.
No, you're right. It's just because, again, it goes back to the replacement value on the waiver wire, and that's one reason I found myself liking 12s more than 15s. It's like 15s is fun. 15s is like playing chess where, you know, 12s is kind of like playing checkers sometimes or like Chinese checkers. It's a little different, but, you know, 15s are great and all, but it's also nice to know when you have an injury or something go wrong, you can at least kind of fill it in with something decent so you can still keep a competitive team where in a 15, it's almost like you're putting a Band-Aid on, it's losing its stickiness already, and it's like you're just hoping it holds.
Yeah, 12s, you can kind of play the weekly game a little bit more of like, okay, I can pick this guy up for this week, drop him, whatever. 15s, like you said, it's kind of like chess. You kind of have to think 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time prior to that week to set yourself up without spending just major dollars, you know, like, because again, everybody's looking at the same players. There's so many podcasts out there. There's so many, you know, great sites out there. Like, everybody knows who the top fab guys are going to be. Yep. But like, you know, if you can get out there before, you know, like, and that's what the best players do. They find these names 2 weeks early or 3 weeks early before anybody's even seen them. And sometimes it's luck. Sometimes it's, you know, paying attention, like, you know, Phil did last year, like who's coming in the seventh or eighth inning, you know, it's little things like that you pick up and you pay a dollar for versus like once one guy gets a save on a Sunday, then all of a sudden everybody wants to spend every type of money on it, even if it is just, the closer was just resting that day, you know?
Yeah, it gets wild, some of the FAF stuff. That's why one of the fun exercises Toby and I do every year is go over how much money was spent that week. Because just like, whoa, what in the world just took place this week? But it happens. It's the way of the world. And it's fun for sure in 15s versus 12, especially. Like 15 is almost more of a structure sort of to your FAB bidding, where 12, it's a wild, like it's league-to-league dependent. It's craziness. So you're going to have, you said, I think 12 OCs, and with how weird the bidding is, are you going to try to keep it the same? Or are you going to do it league? Like, that's going to be a lot of different calculations going on there.
Yeah. A lot of the time, like the way that I've done FAB in the past, like I just take a percentage of whatever remaining FAB budget is left in the league. So like, you know, you could be in a league where everybody blew their money in the first 2 weeks and in another league where nobody really spent money. To me, like the bid should be different because there's just more money out there for people to use or allocate. So like, that's just one of the many things that I do for FAB, but like that kind of helps me on bidding. Like I have a bid range and then like, I look at that and that kind of like helps me narrow it down a little bit.
Now that actually makes a lot of sense. My dumb brain didn't even think about doing the percentages there. That you can definitely fluctuate your bids that way. To make it happen. Now, one thing that we bid on a lot, and you mentioned already, is relief pitching. And anybody that's either done a draft already or just looked at the boards that get posted all the time or just watched listen to any podcast, relief pitchers are flying off the boards. It is chaos, and it's one of those, you either go for it to have someone or you play the late game and see what happens. Like in a FAB world, I don't mind playing the late game. In a DC, it's not the same comfort level for sure. But you have a theory or a strategy you're going with in relief pitching. How are you attacking them so far this year?
Yeah, this is kind of funny. You know, like I know a lot of top guys, like, yes, it's worth paying for the haters, the Hendricks of the world. I think Phil even has said so. He wrote an article about it. And I totally understand the concept behind it. Because you do have to pay the market price. I get that. This is where my experience maybe comes in a little bit. And like, yeah, sure, it's a different year. Every year's different. you know, maybe 5-6 years ago, I tried a dual elite relief pitcher and basically said, okay, I'm going to get an ace in the first or second round and pair the two best relief pitchers to basically make a second ace. And then it addresses my closers. And what happens is you're giving so much up on the other categories to address one category, whether that's a bat in that spot in the second round or third round, or if that's like, you know, a stud pitcher, like you're giving up so much equity, I think, in those picks by taking Hendricks or Hader in the second round. And like, this is coming from a guy like in the shortened season that took Hader in the first round. Yeah. And it failed miserably. So like, I understand the concept behind it. I just think a lot of these players are going to run into finding themselves short on some of the other counting stats, thinking that they can either get it late or whatever, but you just can't replace like that second round type bat or stud pitcher. It's just very, very hard. You have to almost, again, it's the same way. Like, sure, like you can say the same thing if you're going to just throw darts or whatever at the back end of the draft, those darts may not work out. You're going to have to give up something, but I'd rather take a chance on one category than taking a chance on the other 8 or 9, just from my experience of doing it. Now, I could be completely wrong, and these are way smarter people than me, like saying that it's worth it to pay up there. So it's one of those where like, yeah, sure, I'm zigging while everybody's zagging, and like I could win a lot of money this year or lose a lot of money this year. So it's just kind of what I'm going to go with my theory. We'll see. Like, I think in the higher stakes drafts, I think they'll fall a little bit more just because I think more people punt saves, so they're not as demanding. They fall every year from everything else. The main event, like, I'm confused on how people are going to react on the main event. Because usually everybody gets pushed up. I just have a feeling they'll either stay the same or they'll drop just a tiny bit. Like when I'm saying like drop like half a round from where they're going now, you know, because there is so much uncertainty with the lockout and no information on other teams' closers. So like once we start getting more information on like the other half of the league closers, if it's by a committee or if this is the guy or whatever, I think that might loosen some prices up. You know, the Mark Melansons of the world, you know, like that second or third tier from being all the way up there. But again, we'll see, like only time will tell in these March drafts or whenever the lockout ends and we start getting more news.
That's the hard part. It's like right now, I think it's more of just a feeling of uncertainty. It's like, I want to go through and get my guys and like have a better feeling about myself is what it seems like for the most part. But still in a DC, you're taking so many late shots anyways. It's almost like, do you really need to go early? Now, I thought once Fab League started, it would loosen up. And so far, the early OCs are not loosening it up at all. They're like almost going straight with it. I'm just like, I was kind of shocked. I was like, wow, okay. I thought that would have changed because, you know, you can definitely play that game. DC's, I kind of understand the argument. You can't go on the waiver wire and all this stuff. I get it a little bit. The Fab Leagues, I thought for sure people would be like, okay, maybe get one, and then kind of play the game. But no, it's a wild, wild west out there in those streets. And it's so true what you said. It's kind of the argument I've had for catchers in recent years. And I'll take a catcher early too, if it falls in the right spot. But it's the same idea of it's like the replacement value of the player you're passing up on at that early pick of like that, you know, five category, you know, outfielder or something else that you're not going to make up later in the draft. And that makes it tricky when you're taking that relief pitcher that hopefully stays healthy all year. So That's a big predicament to come across, but it'll be really fun to see how it pans out because some people are going to think they're geniuses and it works, or it's going to be the other way, like you said, and you could be the one looking at everybody going, yeah, see, it worked out pretty well. But it's just, I think in the end, no matter if you take them early or not, it's the ones you're going to get like rounds 40 through 50 that show up as closers that's going to win you your league anyways in the grand scheme of things. So we'll see how that one pans out.
Yeah, my OC last night, that's kind of the route I went. I got one closer. And then literally the last, you know, six or seven picks of my draft, I just took darts knowing week one, I'm either going to have a closer for free, basically, or I can just drop them week one anyways. And we can argue whether or not that's a great strategy or not. But in these early drafts, I was like, what I'm already planning on churning and burning it. Like that will just free up seven roster spots already.
It's funny you mentioned that. I've done one Fab League so far. It was a listener league for some other podcast, 12-team league, and did the same exact thing. Like I got, I think in like round between 10 or 12, I had to go back and look. I got like kind of one guy I thought was kind of the guy. Didn't pay too early, but got a guy. And then like my last like five or six picks were all speculative closers. Same idea. Think, yep. Okay, maybe two or three of them hit. If not, I'm going to turn and burn and see what happens, because I guarantee you most, there's going to be like probably five or six closers that no one drafted because we didn't think they were closing. That'll be closing by a first fab run. So
yep.
We'll play the game then too. So I honestly, at this point in time, don't think that's a horrible idea. Cause at the same time, you could go draft bats, as you and I know, that either A, might not even play this year. B, could go get hurt in spring training and not play. You're going to drop them in. There's so many things moving parts there too. So go take your chance with closers. That's the way I see it. So will be interesting for sure. The topic you want to talk about, I like where this is headed. So that's why I wanted to get your thoughts on this. You mentioned with like Phil Dussault, because Phil's going on the podcast tour and he's talking about all his strategies, and the dude's a genius. There's zero hiding that. The guy is by far like he's a robot for a reason, and it's amazing. And I've had him on the show to talk to him. The dude is like, I'm taking notes the entire time. It's crazy how smart he is. But he's got his strategy, you know, take a couple of pitchers early, then a bunch of bats and get pitchers late. It's like, it's kind of a well-known strategy. And then you have Casey Cha, of course, you know, I'm going to cross off my list and walk in with my list of guys, and, or he goes and stacks a team, or he's got, it's like his little strategy too. So you wanted to talk about how trying to replicate these strategies might not be the best of ideas.
Yeah. I mean, again, in theory, like everybody wants to be Phil Dussault and, yep, and Casey Cha, like, yeah, like, sure. Like, yeah, it worked. Like, it's obvious it worked. Like, go look at the money charts. Like you can see it works. But like what a lot of people just don't maybe realize, or maybe they do, and they're just turning a blind eye to it, is like, it works for him. Like he knows what his weaknesses are and his strengths. And he's been very adamant about what they are, but like he knows that, and he builds whatever he drafts, however, to basically cover for that and like go to his strengths. Yep. I may have different strengths and weaknesses. You may have different strengths and weaknesses. So like if you try to copy, you know, Casey or Phil, like you don't have their same repertoire. You're not the same person. You're not looking at the same things they are weekly. Let's just say I feel like I can find late round closers. Well, maybe you can't. So like you're drafting them early and I'm drafting them late, you know? So like, why would I copy you when I feel like I have an advantage on something like that? So like, again, both of them are geniuses. Both of them are like well esteemed. I'm not taking anything away from that. That's not what I'm doing, but it's just like, you know, I've seen so many like on Twitter of like, oh yeah, we're going to cross these players off. And it's like, you know, that's a great strategy if you're crossing off the right players. But what I also mentioned is if you're crossing all these players, you're going to have a lot of the same teams. So as long as you're okay with the variance of being wrong, where either all your teams lose or all your teams win, I mean, that's fine to do. You know, I'm all about conviction plays and like going all in. Like I'm more risk averse than maybe some, but like you have to understand like going in, like, there's more to it than just like working backwards in a draft and like crossing names off. And a lot of people think it's just easy to get the playbook and then copy it. I mean, look, for example, you know, Vlad Sedler, everybody loves him. He's a great fantasy player, puts out his VDP, literally his draft plan. If it was that easy, everybody has his draft plan. Why isn't everybody as good as Vlad that subscribes to it? Well, because Vlad also knows there's intricacies to how to execute things during the draft or in season. Yep. So like, that's why they don't necessarily, you know, Casey's, you know, not really on social media or whatever, but you know, that's why Phil doesn't mind talking about, you know, to a certain extent, or Vlad's out there. Like they all know, like, yeah, they can share information and you can use some of the information against them. But at the end of the day, like you just can't replicate what exactly they're doing. And they know that. They know that. So
yeah, a couple things. Phil, like he's tell you, like he'll tell you a bunch. He won't give you the secret sauce. He won't give you the list of players, all those kind of things. But it's like you said, he goes to his strengths. He knows he can get mid-range pitching later. And, you know, he hit on Carlos Rodon, Dylan Cease, Robbie Ray, Logan Webb. Like he hit the jackpot of all jackpots. Not going to happen in many years, but that's going to take place. Like it was amazing because his system told him that. But it's like, this next year, his system could tell him a completely opposite situation, and now he's sitting there going, "Well, didn't work this year." That's very, very possible.
And you can take all the past overall winners and whatever. Like a lot of things do have to go right. He himself has admit that. Like think about it. Like, he hit on all those pitchers. Well, guess what? You don't have to waste fab on pitchers. So it opens more avenues up for you. So like, again, to win these overalls or whatever, a lot of things do have to go right. But yes, you do have to put in the work. You have to have the right prep work. You do have to hit on the right players, which, you know, he did, winning, what was it, 22 leagues or something. So like, he's doing just fine. Like, he knows what he's doing. What I'm saying is, like,
I agree with what you're saying, because there's so many different ways to draft, is kind of what you're saying. Like, we can all do it different ways, and you got to draft to your strengths. Now, you can use Vlad's VDP to help you with your strengths, to kind of point you in the right direction, but like, Vlad will know how to pivot in the draft where you won't by using his stuff. Like, there's just different things that take place. Or like, I'm in a draft right now where Toby's drafting right next to me, and we text all the time, like, how did this guy fall? Like, it's been a weird draft ADP wise. Like, if you just follow ADP, guys are all over the board. And so it's like, well, I usually don't get these guys at this point in the draft, and I'm getting them this time. So now I got to kind of change my normal philosophy. And it's called adjusting the way you draft and on what's going on. And that's not going to be in a handbook for you. You have to be able to do that with your prep to figure it out. So it's kind of fun to see how that goes. Couple things you mentioned in that little talk there. Crossing guys off list, the right guys off the list. Now, it makes sense with what you're saying. You have to be able to cross the right guys off. But at the same time, a topic of discussion that's been going on the last couple of days has been like, people say, I'm not going to draft a guy. Even if he falls, I'm not going to draft a guy. Or if he falls, now he's worth it to me. And then somebody goes, well, if you didn't like him then, you shouldn't like him now. What's your thoughts on that?
Again, it's very team specific. I think everybody has a value.
You're like the $1 million man. Everyone's got a price.
Yeah, everybody's got a price. Like, you've heard Vlad and Phil even say it, you know, like, yeah, like, I have zero interest in Mondesi this year. But, you know, if he's there at pick 100, I'll make it work, you know. Exactly. You know, so it's like, it's found money kind of at a certain point where, like, even if he doesn't work out, I feel like if it's at whatever point in the draft I'm comfortable to take a certain player, I know I'm taking that risk and chance, even if I didn't like him, knowing, okay, well, week one, I could drop this player and I feel like I can be fine. Like, again, like, that's like very simplified and very dumbing it down, and isn't always the case. But that's what I'm trying to say, is everybody has a value. So just because you cross somebody off, like, you could be missing a chance to take it. Because guess what? We're all wrong, even the best of us. Like, I think Greg does it every year. Like, goes back in the first round, and who actually delivered first round value? It's usually like half at best. And that's the best players, let alone like once we get to round 10 or 11 or 12.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like, it's the old theory is, you know, you're not going to win your draft in the early rounds, but you could probably lose it. But you're going to win drafts later. Make sure you hit those values that stand out. Another thing you mentioned there, you know, diversifying. And this is a question I want to ask you, because you're going to be in so many leagues, 12 OCs and everything. How do you go about diversifying? Are you diversifying in the early rounds to get the same kind of values? Do you prefer to get the big dogs up top and diversify the values? How do you, like, going into a draft, obviously things can change, as we've talked about, but what's your game plan? Do you try to get, like, a certain, like, section of the draft similar and be different somewhere else, or what do you do?
You know, it's kind of changed for me over the years. Before, like, man, when I was all in on a player, I didn't care if it was in the first round or second round, I'd draft him on every team if I would. Granted, that's more of an all-in approach, and the variance is very high, because if that first rounder goes down, then all your teams have that first rounder go down. So it may have not been the smartest thing in the book to do. But again, like, I'm more risk adverse. So, like, you know, like, if I really believe in a guy, like, I'm going to take him regardless. I've kind of calmed down and tried more diversifying. My partner that I do these drafts with, Matt Shepard, I'm sorry. He believes in diversifying a lot, which I'm just kind of like, no, like, I want the best players, especially on the best teams. Like, I don't care, like, if we got DeGrom and the other diamond, like, I want DeGrom and this diamond, you know. Mm-hmm. He's more kind of like, oh, let's get a different pitcher. Like, they're the same guy. That's kind of like, we have that argument back and forth still to this day. But I've calmed down on maybe I diversify a little bit more. But my initial thought is, like, I'm the type of player that, like, it doesn't matter early, late, middle. Like, if I really like a guy, I'll probably take him there every single time.
Gotcha. Guys, there's nothing wrong with that at all. What are you doing with the NLDH? Are you worried about it? Is it affecting your strategy any differently?
I've been planning all offseason that there will be an NLDH. And if there's not, like, I'll adjust to it. But I've just been playing like that, which, again, in these early DCs, I think there's just a lot of value if you can kind of pick and choose the players you think will get the at-bats. I don't think in the NL, especially in this first year, there'll be a lot of just like typical DH. Okay, this guy's going to get 600 at-bats at DH. I think NL managers will kind of play it the same way they have been in interleague, which is like, okay, I'm going to use it to get a day off for a guy, which I think most American League teams have started to do now too, where there's just fewer DH type guys and they use it more of a rotating spot. So it's more, I think, okay, like a perfect example. It's like okay, here's a part-time guy, like a Darren Ruff or whatever. Like, okay, we're planning for 400 at bats. Steamer's planning for 400 at bats. Like, I know Steamer's updated to the DH now, but it's like, okay, you might think they play him a little bit more than Steamer does. So it's like you adjusting that up or down either way kind of affects his draft price to you. So like, I think that's going to be maybe the key this year is identifying who's right a little bit more on identifying the players that are going to get the extra at bats maybe. If they do have an NLDH, even from the top guys.
Well, I'm kind of with you there. The Dodgers, I remember back in 2020, flat out said it's our revolving day off. Like, we're just like, you know, today Will Smith's going to be there. Tomorrow it's going to be Max Muncy and so on and so forth. Like, so like Justin Turner, for instance, assuming he stays healthy, of course, but like him and AJ Pollock, you could maybe factor in like 10 more games of just DHing.
Yeah,
like that could be, I said, like that could be 40 at bats or something. So yeah, just little things like that that could maybe help them stay healthier throughout the year, keep them out of the field, stuff like that. Because like when you look at the projections, those guys are always hurt. I was looking at them earlier today. Like Turner, I think, Pollock's around maybe 120 games or something. Maybe you throw them in at like 130 now or something along those lines and just kind of play with it. And that's kind of a fun discussion I've had with some previous NFBC guys on the show is, how are you projecting playing time? Because of you look at Dalton Varsho is projected to play like 103 games now with the DH. And it's like, I'm sorry, if he's going to play in the outfield like he's supposed to, he's playing a lot more than 103 games. So you got to start like prorating things around. And that's kind of, I think, the fun and really like fine tuning how you're approaching the drafts come draft season. Do you have a specific set of projections you like? Do you make your own projections? Do you have your own sheet you use? Are you a Phil Dussault type, or how do you go about prepping for these drafts?
So I do use RotoLab, and basically it's like a combination of Master Balls, Steamer, the Bat X, especially for hitting, even Razzball. You know, they come out with their own kind of deal. Basically, kind of like we'll mess around and then add my own input on maybe more of like, I'll basically get an average from that and be like, okay, this is what they're thinking basically per at bat. And then I'll kind of put in what I think the at bats will be for a certain player. And then whatever it spits out, like that's what I'm going to go with. And then I rank them that way.
Gotcha. No, that makes a lot of sense. Lots and lots of sense. Any other strategies that are standing out to you in your early draft season, draft prep, that may be something that you're willing to try out a bit or just like stood out to you like, whoa, this is way different than I'm used to?
You know, as far as strategies, I'm a little shocked about the closure still that we talked about, but like, it's kind of just like how to take advantage of that thinking for me. And it's just kind of, when I first was growing up, I guess in the NFBC was, Steve Japinka just telling me constantly, yeah, bully hitting and manage pitching. So like, that's kind of the mindset that's always stayed with me. And so it's like, okay, well, these guys are going to take closers. I'm just going to keep like attacking, hitting, and like make them chase me. So it's kind of like one of those things. It's like, yeah, I understand I'm giving up this one category and maybe like some ratio help, but I want to at least make them worry about trying to catch me in the other categories.
No, I'm with you. That's one thing I've started to change my mindset to a little more this year is, especially with pitching. I think it's deeper, or at least feels like. Like it might not be deep, but it's the kind of, instead of the top like three guys and it's like the next 12 guys, it's more like there's like, seven or eight, maybe 10 really good guys. And there's like, feels like 30 or like there's a group of guys where you're just like, differentiating those is going to be a big part of winning, obviously, but you can make arguments for so many more guys. It feels like to give them a shot as like your third or fourth pitcher on your team or something compared to the years past. So you can attack hitting a lot more. And it's a strategy I've been kind of going with. It's like, I took a starting pitcher not to like round six or seven the other day, just like little things like that, just pounding the hitting early. And it's not easy, but it's better off than I thought it would be like in years past. Let's put it that way. So it's definitely a philosophy that can take place that as you tinker with the season. That's fun about these early drafts, kind of plan and see what happens and hopefully win some money with it, but get ready for the big dogs in the end. Let's talk Astros. I have a lot of questions for you, as you saw. And it's like I started making a couple, and I started just going around the diamond in my head. I'm like, I got questions about like everybody on this team, because it's like there's a lot about these guys. So we're just going to start.
You know, my last name is not Baker, though, right?
Well, as a Giants fan, Dusty and I have a mixed relationship. There was some good.
Yeah. So do we. So
yeah,
do we.
So I understand. I understand completely that there's certain days you're just like, are you still here? Are you focused on what's the task at hand, my friend? But then there's other days where he looks like he knows what he's doing. So you never know. But let's just kind of go around the horn here, and we'll start with Alex Bregman. You know, a video came out the other day. He's hitting the cage. You know, great. But he had that wrist surgery, and when the news came out, because it was kind of a surprise, it felt like, to at least not less non, like it just got tweeted out one day, like, hey, Bregman just had a successful surgery. And someone like the, you know, Savali, Nick Savali, that does, you know, baseball rehab work and stuff on Twitter and everything, was kind of giving his insight. Derek Rose was kind of giving his, like, past history on it. And we were kind of torn because it surprised everybody. So what are you hearing out of Houston? Like, is he expected to be ready by opening day? Are they concerned about the power? Because anytime you see a wrist injury, there's got to be some power concern.
Yeah, it's kind of like just a whole weird thing. And, like, me and Matt have talked about it. You know, Matt's a surgeon out in California, so it's like he's, like, the perfect person to talk to about this. But, like, there's zero information about, like, is it a fracture? Is it bone? Is it ligament? Is it tendon? Like, is it muscle? All these things kind of matter differently. Mm-hmm. And like after talking with him, like, you know, it's like why everybody's off, like, I shouldn't say everyone. Well, like why I'm off Mike Trout for the same kind of reasons with power concerns. Like he's in a territory where, like, I'm not necessarily avoiding him, but I don't necessarily love him or have really been taking him all season. Like if he drops, maybe another 20, 30 picks, like, okay, yeah, that's probably in the territory that I'm going to start going. But, like, the one thing with Bregman, like, he lost his kind of juju. And, like, I know that sounds weird, and that's not really analytics or anything, but, like, he's always been a very, like, cocky type hitter and just lost that the last couple of years. He kind of is starting to get it, is getting it back, I guess. And that's the only thing that kind of makes me, like, he definitely has, you know, 100, like, 200 runs / RBI upside with, you know, 25 to 30 home runs in him, and he can run a little bit. Like, you know, I'm not saying a lot, but he could throw in 5 stolen bases for you. But that's assuming, like, if the Astros let him play. Like, I think if he is the type of player that will play every single day if he's even remotely close to playing. So, like, I'm not necessarily concerned about playing time, maybe them taking it slow or whatever. But without knowing the second what exactly is in that wrist that he had surgery on, I've kind of just been avoiding him at this point.
And that's where I'm at. It's one of those, like, you know, there's so many guys when you're on the clock, you know, your 2-hour clock or whatever, and you're kind of scrolling through to make sure you haven't missed anything. And you're like, man, it's Bregman. It's like pick 100. And you're like, this feels weird because Bregman should not be going here in years past. And if he's healthy, this is a steal, but it's a big if, because we don't know. It could be the Trout thing, like you said. It just, it lingers.
Which is why you're getting the discount.
Yeah, it's exactly why you're getting the discount. Like, if he shows up on opening or of spring training and, you know, he puts on this display, like Willie Mays Hayes in Major League, you're just like, okay, here we go. He's back to like a third round pick again. But it's tough. It's tough to take the gamble there with the other pieces around. So I was curious if you guys have heard anything in Houston, because it's weird. It came so out of nowhere with what was going on. So it was very strange.
Yeah. I mean, they had talked about it a little bit, like at the end of the year and like through the playoffs, that he was going to have to get something done. But again, there was really no specifics as to what it was. And it seemed relatively minor, but like teams aren't very forthcoming with injuries now. So they like to downplay things already.
And we know the, like, Astros relaying information. So
again, it just depends. Like if we have a spring training and the, you know, like whatever, like I don't think he stays at this price. Right. Cause like if spring comes and we start to get more news about what actually occurred and like how the recovery went and we see him in games, like I think he will go up. Like, I don't think he's going to go up drastically, but he might go on to like that 75-80 pick range, you know, with good news. And then maybe the opposite way, if there's more bad news or it was more non, like more major than everybody thought, you know? So like, I don't think he's going to stay around this pick. So it's definitely, if you want to hedge bets or whatever, like he'll probably not stay around 100 either in March.
Yeah. So it's plant your flag. Do you yeah. believe or do you don't? This kind of situation. Yeah. So that's the beauty of these early drafts. You can find little spots like that. Let's talk Jose Altuve, a player that is, it's weird because, you know, the power was there last year, not running a ton anymore, but he's doing everything else. The average, he's going to score a ton of runs. So at the top of that order, you got to love what you're getting out of Altuve, but it's just like, he's always getting older and it seems like he's just not getting the love he once got. He's like pick 80 right now in the month of January in a draft champions drafts. But the dude, like there's like a pocket of consistent players throughout the draft and Altuve is one of them. So am I just like overthinking this that he should be like an automatic here, or is there something more to concern yourself with and that's why he's going later?
Yeah, like I've been picking Altuve, you know, looking into him a little bit more, he definitely changed his swing approach. Like he's definitely very, very pull happy, which is great for the Crawford boxes. But, you know, like I've been trying to research, like if he's talked about more of that, because he's a professional hitter. He's like the Miguel Cabreras of the world, you know, like he knows how to hit, like he could easily bat 300 if he wanted to and take away power, or he can hit for power. It seems like the Astros want him hitting for more power, which is why the pull happy kind of approach has done it. But like, if you go look at the Statcast page, it's crazy that there's almost like no balls hit the right field. And it's just very weird for a guy that is a professional hitter and like I know can hit to all fields. So with that being said, like, you know, he probably gets shifted a little bit more this year and his average probably might go down because of that if he's going to stay with that type of pull happy. But I think the homers are there, the runs are there, you know, like that lineup is decent enough, especially if Bregman can stay healthy. Even if Correa moves on, which I do think, you know, I think it's deep enough where it's not necessarily going to affect him too much, but like, I like his price there. I don't love it, but he's fine.
Around that ADP going two picks later is Brandon Lau. Would you have Altuve or Lau?
They kind of have different qualms about them, you know, like, you know, Lau's concern is he easily could get platooned. Tampa already loves doing that anyways, but like he is one of the few guys that consistently has gotten to play every day too in the past. So you kind of have to make a decision on that. Not a cop out, but like they're pretty even to me, but yeah. I do have more shares of Brandon Lau than Altuve at this point.
It feels like Lau might have the higher ceiling right now, which is weird to say because I've been an anti-Lau guy until recently. I've, you know, you learn as you grow, you learn to realize where you're wrong and why, and I was wrong on Brandon Lau. So we'll see where that continues to go. Let's go to a guy I know you like quite a bit, and I'm with you on this one. I'm very, very intrigued with what he does this year. But Kyle Tucker, is he worth this first-round pick? His current ADP in January is about pick 11 right now, as high as 7, as low as 17.
Yeah, I saw even Brian Vogel ask a question on Twitter, and we kind of go back and forth because it's like we're the leaders of his fan club. I didn't expect, I'll be honest, like I was on him in 2020. I was not on him in 2021. But after what I've seen and kind of like looking into him more, I'm back in for this year. I honestly think like, again, I'm not saying he's going to, but he does have a Juan Soto type year in him. You know, like I easily could see him, you know, 100 plus RBIs, 100 plus runs, you know, 30 to 35 homers, chipping in maybe 5 to 10 steals. And then I think his average easily could go up. Like if you go look after April, you know, again, we can just manipulate numbers however we want. But like from May on, he batted almost like 320. And with, you know, the counting stats and home runs there. So like, if he can put it together for a full season and then just continually just keep the path that he's on with, you know, and growing as a hitter, like, you know, he batted 6th and 5th a lot in the Astros lineup, but with Correa gone, I easily could see him maybe taking Brantley's place in the 2 spot. I could see him being in a 3-hole or 4-hole. You know, it's tricky with Dusty Baker because, like, yes. For whatever reason, like, it doesn't seem like he likes Kyle Tucker as maybe as much as me.
He loves his veterans.
Like, And even the first year I was on him, it didn't seem like they were wanted to give him a chance. And like, I don't know. So if they let him play every day, like me and Brian think, like, I think he easily could be a top five pick next year. Like I really love him and where he's going. Like I would take him over a lot of the earlier hitters, going in the first.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of his, like even back, when they were trying to make trades and everything. And I was like, you can trade a lot of guys. Do not trade Kyle Tucker. Like, you're going to regret trading Kyle Tucker. They went and traded Teoscar. I remember I saw him when they were playing in Fresno and the Astros team was in Fresno. And I was like, Teoscar had a big day. He was pounding the ball everywhere. He had a cannon from the outfield. I'm like, great player. Toronto got a good one and turned out to be good. But you kept Kyle Tucker. Like, keep Kyle Tucker because he's a legit like 30-30 dude if things start to click. Maybe 30-20. I think he's got the speed to do it, but we'll see if they let him run.
Yeah, like he rarely gets caught stealing, but for whatever reason, I don't know if it's like where he is in the lineup or what. Like, they just don't really let him run that often. I don't know if it's him or the Astros. I don't really know, but yeah. Like,
darn good player. So I think it's fun. Like when I came back from First Pitch Arizona, I already started talking about like, okay, I had bets over him. He goes way over bets now. I'm past that. Like, we moved on from there. Now it's like Harper versus Tucker is an interesting discussion to me because I can see both sides. Like, we've seen Harper do it a bunch of times. If you kind of want that, you know, I've done it before in your first round pick. Sure. You want to go for the moon? Got Tucker. I'm assuming you go Tucker over Harper.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about Tucker versus Acuna? Because we don't know he's fully healthy, but things look promising.
Yeah, I'd still take Tucker over Acuna, even if like he comes back in spring and kind of shows. I think the Braves just play it safe with his knee. Like, I'm not saying it's going to be a full stop, but like, you know, he may have 20 instead of going for 40 stolen bases that type of year if he's healthy going into spring and showcases everything.
Yeah, that's my biggest concern. Is like, I don't have a question that he'll probably play early in the season. Is how much does he run? Like, does he not run to like the All-Star break or something? That could be very possible, and that changes a lot of things there. So. I love Acuna, but I think it's a tough one. Another tough one to go early in the drafts. What is a tough one is who the heck are the Astros playing at shortstop this year?
You know, I think it's going to be a veteran still. Like, I know there's been more talk about Jeremy Peña starting the year. Like, he is a defensive wizard. Like, they played him in winter ball. He's getting the time, and like Tampa, you know, James Click is from Tampa, so he's not afraid of like letting a rookie start. But again, it's just that Dusty Baker factor. Like, I just can't believe that he's going to let a rookie shortstop from Korea be his starting shortstop come opening day. Like, they're like, you know, I've been a big believer they're going to sign Story, kind of replace, because they offered, you know, Korea that 5-year. What, 160? So it seems like they have like $150 million to play with, which is kind of what Story's been rumored to kind of get, and kind of would, I think, almost replace Correa's bat like almost pretty identically.
Well. Pretty well. And he'd run more.
Yeah. I think he'd fit perfectly here. Now, again, it's not my money and it's not my team. So like, even if it is Peña, like I still think they signed some type of veteran. You know, I think Diaz plays there even a lot now. Like, I think he'd play against lefties and maybe Peña plays against right. Like, I don't think it's going to be a full-time role, even if it is Peña with the job to start. Like, no way he just hands it over and gives him the keys.
Yeah, it's a fun one. I know we have Vlad Stelar talking about Solomon and some other guys. It's up for grabs right now. It looks like it's shortstop. But let's go to the outfield where something else is up for grabs. Like, we know Tucker should be there every day. You still got Michael Brantley there, and he's up just a pure hitter. There's nothing wrong with what Michael Brantley does. But then you had McCormick last year. You had Siri last year. You had a couple other guys chip in from time to time. How do you attack this come draft day?
You know, with Brantley, like, especially later on, he was having a lot of, like, you know, leg issues, and Baker was basically keeping him out of the outfield and maybe DHing him a lot more, even playing Yordan out there just to give Brantley a break. So that tells me, like, Brantley's not an everyday player that much anymore. Like, because again, like, are you going to put Yordan out there and sacrifice defense? You know, Yordan's really a DH to begin with, and he has his own leg problems. So it's kind of this weird thing where, like, Brantley's a professional hitter too, and like, he's great as a number two hitter. Like, he needs to be in the lineup, but I think he gets a little bit more breaks this year. I think Dusty wants to keep him fresh, especially if they're thinking about another playoff run. I think you'll see maybe Jose Siri play against lefties a little bit more. You know, I think Baker kind of gained some respect for him in the playoffs. You know, McCormick will start in center, I think. They're pretty happy with him. I mean, they traded away the infamous straw trade just because they wouldn't play McCormick, and that was their way of figuring that out. But, like, the guy I really love is Jake Myers, and I understand he's coming off of shoulder surgery, but, like, man, this kid, like, I think I'm thinking, like, he's going to take over one of those jobs, whether it's due to injury or just playing time, over McCormick or whatever by, like, June or July. Like, that's how much I believe in him. Like, he's pretty much going after that. I think they're around the same time as Jose Siri in draft. That's the guy I would bet on. Maybe not – he's not going to get you playing time initially, and especially in 15-team leagues. But you can't really – he's not a guy worth holding on to start the season and just, like, sit there for a month. But he's somebody I'm definitely interested in, like, once he starts coming up.
Yeah, I know John Fish, you know, the guy that drafts 50,000 leagues, he's done a lot of drafts where he takes, like, all three of those outfielders at the end. He's like, I'm going to have the center fielder for the Astros, and it's going to be fun. So it's one way to do it, I guess. So it's definitely interesting. Let's go to the mound. And I already saw your notes on this one. It makes me very happy, and I'm kind of afraid to ask a question now because I don't want people to hear this. But what's your outlook on Justin Verlander? Because I think he's a great value right now.
Yeah, I think the best comparison I've heard so far, I think it was I want to say it was Rob Silver, but he was like, what's the difference between Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander right now? Like, why is Scherzer going, you know, into the first, top of the second, and Verlander's going, you know, pick 100, 110? And it's just all uncertainty, you know? Like, there's less uncertainty with Scherzer than there is Verlander, but, like, Verlander's, like, had way more time to recover. It, like, if the season was still going to go on in, like, November, he probably would have started pitching in November. But, like, so he's had these extra even months to prepare normally. He's got an incentive-laden contract where basically 150 innings guarantees him another, like, you know, ungodly $30 million or something like that. So, like, to me, that tells me that he's pretty confident that he can do 150 innings. Like, he may not be the stud, like, 200 inning, 220, like he's been in the past, but I think he's going to be very, very damn good for 150 to 160 innings.
And it's also the argument I've had this whole time is, unlike young kids coming back from TJ where they baby him back, they're giving Verlander the ball and he's going to go because he doesn't have many more years in that arm. And so once he's cleared to go, he's going. And that's my biggest thing.
Yeah. And they just signed him to a contract. So, like, if they didn't think he was ready to go, they wouldn't have gave him $50, $60 million thinking, okay, we're just going to wait for next year. And that, like, that's our way of getting you for next year. Like, I think they really truly believe that he's ready to go. That's why, you know, they did the pitching showcase. That's why the Yankees and other teams were actively trying to grab him too. Like, everybody knows he's a veteran, which again helps in a lockout year where, like, yeah, you don't have the rehab and the coordinator's helping you. Like, he's been through this. Like, he knows how to rehab. I think he's just back. And again, I think his price, he's not going to stay here. Again, he's another guy in the spring. Like, he's going to jump up once everybody starts seeing the 95, 96 on the radar gun again.
He'll be up there by Chris Sale, and then we'll be talking. So it'll be fun. Lance McCullers, he's a guy that keeps falling in drafts now because of the way the season ended, the kind of dead arm / forearm strain that MRI has revealed no damage. He started throwing recently. He responded to Eno Saris saying, yes, I'm throwing. He's had that pitcher list interview, which is actually pretty good, talking about what he's got going on. And I love Lance McCullers, but I'll be honest, I'm nervous as heck. And I've had a trouble drafting him right now. So the price is great if you can get the innings, but I'm terrified of what's to come. So what's your thoughts on Lance McCullers?
Yeah, no, I get that. And again, maybe it's just because I'm a little bit more risk averse. So, like, you know, he's an ace like pitcher, you know, if he is healthy, and that's a big if, I know. But, like, you know, everybody said kind of the same thing about Tanaka, you know, when he had his elbow issues and, like, oh, his arm's going to fall off. Like, he needs, I don't know why he's not getting surgery. And, like, just avoid. And he went out there for 2-3 years and just pitched on it and did just fine. Like, is McCullers going to do the same thing? Who knows? Like, he easily can blow up week one after his first start and be shut down and, like, then get TJ. And it's like, well, why did you not just do this in the first place? he's kind of a warrior. He's also kind of been through that process. So like, yeah. I'm kind of more trusting the player a little bit more, which I know is not a good thing most of the time, but the fact that management kind of didn't push for it either makes me believe that they see something structurally where they can maybe see like, okay, there is a path back. Like, you know, again, the landscape has changed. They don't need McCullers to go out and pitch 200 innings. They're thinking, okay, if he can give us 140 to 150 innings, that's more than enough. And I think that's more than enough that you need for in fantasy these days. So like, to me, I'm like, okay, I'm in on the price. I like the price. I have no issue, especially in Fab Leagues.
That's what I was going to say. Fab Leagues, I could see myself doing it a lot more.
Yeah, because again, he's what I kind of talked about earlier. Like, if it doesn't work out, he's done. Like yep. He's an easy drop, you know? Yep. And yeah, you're giving up a middle round pick to do that. But again, it's like, you're not tied to that player. You can make a decision pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that's to be like the DCs, you still have such a deep pool, so I could see you doing it. There's something about there's so many injuries, you kind of want that guy. But like in the month of January, he's going to pick 182 right now. Like even in DCs, that's kind of feasible. But in a Fab League, if it's like 150 on, like legit, you could grab him and drop him if you had to. Like that's not really that big of a deal compared to some of these other guys. So I think I'm going to be getting more involved in him as I get more towards the Fab experience. I guess in DCs, I've been a little more hesitant, and maybe that's a fault of mine, but I love Lance McCullers, and I agree. The fact he's already throwing and he's been through it before is something on the positive side for sure. Framber Valdez, this is a guy that I love. I know he can walk guys a lot, which can be a little scary, but the dude's a horse. He's going to give you innings. He's usually a decent strikeout guy more often than not. Is he a potential fantasy ace in the future? Maybe not this year. Or is he more just like, you know, middle of the pack guy that good to fill out your roster?
You know, Framber's kind of like this weird case of like, he pitches very deep into games. Like the one thing, again, like one of the hardest things that we have to project is like wins, right? And so it's almost like a disregarded, talked about category. But the one thing he does do is he's on a good team. He usually goes 6 or 7 because, you know, he's just very efficient in what he does. And he's kind of in that range of a strikeout, an inning, a little bit below. But again, like where he's going, you kind of – the reason why I like drafting him is, you know, he's more in line to maybe get you wins. He's not going to kill you in ERA and whip. Do I think he's like a future ace? No, I think he's more of the Keuchel.
Reminds me a lot of Keuchel.
And I know that's a weird comparison as far as like everybody says it. It's just an easy comparison, but like they're just very, very similar, like ground ball specialists. The one thing, again, like that helps is if Jeremy Pena is the shortstop, he is a defensive wizard, so that helps Valdez. If they bring in Story, he's a pretty good defensive shortstop, so like that helps him. So, but if it's like somebody like Diaz, like he's okay, but again, like then it starts to be a little bit more concerning for Valdez. So like, it's all about the defense, I think, and what they put behind him that kind of makes Valdez who he is.
No, that makes a lot of sense. That's kind of, he seemed to have fantasy relevance because he like accumulated through his innings, not so much that he dominated like, you know, Garrett Cole or DeGrom could throw 5 innings and strike out 11 and get the job done, where Framber's got to throw like 7 to get his 6 to 7 strikeouts. Like he's got to go in there to make it kind of work for you. So two different types of a way to get there. Luis Garcia, 155 innings last year. Very, very sharp, good looking stuff. For one, the innings, that's just a great thing because now we can kind of build off of that going forward. But you always pick 132 right now. Is that too rich? Or should we be like, yes, let's have some? What's your thoughts on Luis Garcia?
Yeah, I think he's the number two right now in the Astros rotation. I really, really like him. I like his kind of swagger, his stuff. He's another one that's got a little bit more K upside, but he's still very, very efficient. You know, it's kind of weird. He kind of came out of nowhere. Wasn't necessarily like the expectations for him doing this wasn't really there. So it's kind of found money for the Astros. I have zero problem with where he's going. So buy is what I have to say.
I was looking at roster resource right now, and I didn't put it on the outline, but it stood out to me in a big way. Christian Javier is projected to start in the minors. What are your thoughts on that? Because that guy was filthy last year.
Yeah, again, I don't know how they really do that. All that really tells me is they must think that he's a sixth starter, which I think he is. And I think I don't necessarily know the Astros' plan with that. Like, I know they liked him in the relief role last year, but that was kind of like a way to manage innings because he started. And basically they had their starter, so they kind of could afford to do that to manage his innings. But he is a starter. I know they view him as a starter. I like him as a starter. He's kind of useless in the bullpen. Like, you know, he's not necessarily a setup guy like a Neris or somebody. Like, you know, he's a multi-inning type guy, but he doesn't necessarily isn't like the shutdown, just back of the end type guy. So, like, you know, he's a good sixth, seventh inning type reliever, I would say. But like, as a starter, I think that's where his real value is. And like, he can give you good five innings, you know. Mm-hmm. But again, like, it's just the chance is not there for Houston, in Houston right now for him.
Yeah, no, I like taking chances on him in the draft champions, because I think he's still gonna end up getting a handful of starts at some point this season. But Fab League's a little tricky for sure. Let's head to the bullpen. Presley, 26 saves last year, 12 in the shortened season. He's looked pretty good. Good strikeout stuff for the Astros. Is he pretty much the dude, or is there any concern of someone potentially taking that over?
Yeah, he's the guy. I mean, like, there's zero concern. Like, they were pitching Presley in every key situation in the playoffs. They know he's their Baker knows he's his best reliever. Like, he's just steady Eddie. Doesn't get too high. Doesn't get too low. That's exactly the makeup you like. You know. He's kind of like that Mark Melanson deuce back in Mark Melanson's kind of like heyday, you know, like, he wasn't this flashy guy, but he just would get the job done every single day. I mean, you could, I guess, say the same thing now.
Yeah.
It's just never pretty. But like, you know, back in his heyday, it was pretty shut down. Like, he wouldn't get the three strikeouts, but it'd be ground ball, pop up, ground ball. And 10 pitches later, the game's ended. So.
Yep, that's what he does. That's what he does very, very well. You know, we didn't talk about Jordan or Brantley or anybody else. Does anybody else stand out to you that we need to kind of be jumping on in drafts, or thoughts on some of these other Astros players?
Yeah, I love Jordan. To be honest, I think he's a great bet for AL MVP. Like, I think he's a second round value. He's kind of been going late second, early third. Kind of been trending up there a little bit here over the last 2-3 weeks. But yeah, like, if he's in the third round, especially middle of the third round, like, oh man, I love that. Like, I understand that he has no speed, but like he easily could put up a Vlad season, maybe a little bit less runs, but like, he's got, you know, he can hit for average, he can hit for power. He's a run producer in a good lineup, like, hits the cover off the ball. Like, I love him this year. It would not be a surprise at all if he wins the MVP.
Yeah. Pick 33 in the month of January. So not too shabby there, end of round two, early round three, to get it done for you. Let's talk about some other players that are of interest for you here early in draft season. You had a fun list here that kind of lets us spitball some other things. But one guy you liked was Freddy Peralta, who, you know, we've seen it in Milwaukee. You had the Woodruff, and he's a lockdown guy. Now, you had Burns last year, obviously. Peralta was very solid last year, you know, surprised many, with, I think, with 144 innings when there's, you know, even on opening day, he was out of the bullpen behind Lindblom for one day, and then it all flipped. So what's your thoughts on Freddie this year? Because this Brewers team is, you know, starting to show they can develop these studs.
Yeah, you know, this is, you know, I've always been a Freddie, like, truther. I don't know what you want to call it, but I've always been a little fanboy of him. So I've liked him kind of before Burns and Woodruff. Like, he's kind of been my guy on that team, and it hasn't really necessarily worked out yet. Obviously, those two are way better. I will say, like, you know, I got to get a little bit of odds, you know, I'm just like a gambling man. Like, I'll take Peralta against one of those two, as far as like out earning him this year. I think he takes a jump. You know, he's got great movement on his fastball. Like, if he, to me, the key with him is him committing, to maybe throwing the changeup a little bit more, but especially the slider. If he can throw the slider a little bit more, like, he's got a great curveball. And he's got a phenomenal slider. And if he turns that pitch a little bit more, I think the K's go way up. I think, you know, the baby gloves with him are kind of going to finally come off a little bit. And like, I see him around 180 starting innings this year, which I know that's like, oh, that's not really that much. But like, when most of the starters are going 150, like, yeah. 180 is the new kind of 200 in our fantasy baseball landscape. So like, that's kind of like the floor I see him. Like anything above that's just gravy. But like, I love him as price. Like, and I'll probably own a lot of him this year.
Yeah, I don't blame you at all. 180 would be outstanding because we've seen what you know, even Woodruff and Burns could do at 180. And Peralta, like you said, I wouldn't be shocked if he outproduces them. I'm still a believer in those guys. Like Woodruff's kind of a floor guy. Burns, we saw the ceiling. Peralta definitely has that upside. I'm 100% with you. We've seen it time and time again. And it would be interesting if he kind of mixed that. That was the fun part last year is, you know, he added a pitch to the pitch mix. And now he wasn't a two pitch guy. And that was a big thing. And now it's okay. Let's utilize that third pitch some more. Let's really make some things happen. I'm with you because that's how these guys do take the next step. So we'll be fun. And let's make that team even nastier. If you have three guys that could literally go out there and throw seven plus almost every time out, like what that does for a bullpen is ridiculous. So it'll be, and plus in that division, the Pirates, the Cubs are rebuilding. You got some fun little matchups to toy with as well. So
yeah, the Brewers just as a team, especially with those three, it just makes it easy because you got Hader and Devin Williams in the back. Like, how are you supposed to hit against like 3 out of 5 days of the week with the?
It's rough.
You know, like, yeah, you're like, oh yes, Adrian Hauser next tomorrow. Thank God, you know.
I remember when the Giants had to play him last year in September, like big games for both teams were like getting into the playoffs and like Giants obviously trying to keep the Dodgers away. And it was like that, like, okay, once Woodruff, Burns, and might not have been Peralta, but they faced 2 out of 3 every time. I'm just like, this is ridiculous right now. Yeah. It wasn't fair watching what was going on. So yeah, the Brewers, it's going to be one of these years soon where they're going to make a serious run because it's just going to click. Like the in the postseason so far, it's just their offense has been cold. They've run into walls and they just haven't hit. The pitching's so good, though. It's going to be – that's a team like perennially, and the odds are obviously not as good as they used to be, but that's one of those like World Series odds. You just got to look at them because if you can put three aces out there in a postseason series, dangerous, very dangerous. Yep. And this Ashby kid who everybody loves, that could be another monster if things come to fruition. So we'll see how that goes. Will Smith, catcher. Like, you know, we talk about JTR. We talk about what Salvi did last year. Dalton Varsho, Grandal, Contreras. Will Smith's in the discussion as well. You like Will Smith a little more than others, it seems like.
Yeah, I think he's the best catcher on the board. I think I've been saying this since the end of last year. Like, he's my number one. Like, I think a lot of people are downplaying, like, with the NLDH and having his bat in the lineup, like that's third again for a great Dodgers lineup that could even get better, you know, if they add a Freddie Freeman or something like that. And it's just all about at bats, him, his growth and, you know, the lineup construction. I think a lot of people just are downplaying. Like, I know Salvi had a great year last year, you know, and again, he's been more of an accumulator kind of his year, his entire career. You know, JTR is still, again, to me, JTR has kind of been more trending that way as an accumulator versus kind of like, oh, well, like he's a must have on a per game basis. I think Will Smith, like, especially if you play DFS, like he's always priced up and like he's always almost a must own on a DFS slate. So like maybe that's where my love came from, just playing him in DFS all last year. But yeah, like to me, he's the top catcher on the board. So getting him as the third and pick 65-70, like, yeah, I'll take it every day.
Yeah, no, he was a DFS darling, that's for sure. Well, the Dodgers were always a fun late night hammer, but Will Smith is the one that kind of got forgotten about because catchers get forgotten about, especially expensive catchers. So he was always a fun one for those that paid attention to those kind of things. With Will Smith, I think it's a fun conversation. I don't know if maybe I just don't listen to the right show, but it seems like it doesn't get talked about enough because one of the conversations about Salvi and JTR is, like, and you mentioned accumulated, is they get tons of at-bats because they play a ton. Will Smith played 130 games last year. Maybe with the DH, plays 135 to 140. I think that's fair. Maybe a little more. You never know. But is it safe to say in a world where you mentioned Zimmerman and Phil and these guys, it's like, say, plate appearances, with the catcher's position, I know the emphasis on the guys is, but should we be more worried about just comparing the stats that most catchers put up compared to actual plate appearances? Because it's not like you're playing an outfielder at the catcher's position just because you have an open spot, if that makes any sense. But it's like we're sitting here comparing the need for at-bats when most catchers just don't get at-bats. So let's take the quality of a Will Smith over these guys that accumulate, as you say. Does that make sense at all, is what I'm trying to say there?
Kind of. I think I might know where you're going with that. Like, like catchers have a lot of negative values. So yes. Like, is it better to just like, you know, have a negative value catcher, even if he's going to get plate appearances? Like, I'm more of the, like, yeah, I'd rather almost take the backup catcher that might only get 9 at bats in the entire week. If, like, a perfect example, like more of a DC guy, you know, like an Andrew Knizer, like somebody like that, like Molina's going to play every single day. Yep. And Knizer probably maybe gets 1, maybe 2 games at most. It's like, okay, well, I'm almost fine eating a 0 just because everybody else is going to be just negative value, unless you're Mike Zunino. And that's just like a running joke. You know, I'm a Mike Zunino guy. And I understand of how much everybody hates him, but like, I just love him for so many different reasons.
He mashes lefties, destroys them. But it's just something I've started looking at more and more, like especially this latest draft, because I try to get like one of the top, you know, 6-7 catchers, like one of them, and then I'll pair them down the list. But this draft, like, guys are just flying off of them, so I kind of just let it go, and I'm focusing more on the lower catchers, and they're all the same. So it's like, why are we trying to overemphasize certain things and just kind of go and, I don't know, it's a process going through draft season. Like, why are we focused on this so much?
Yeah, I've typically been a punt catcher type player. The only reason why I'm taking Will Smith is just because I think he's just a tremendous value.
Oh, he's so a stud. Like, he's a stud.
Yeah. And for my second catcher, unless it's another specific catcher, I'm basically punting the position. And like you said, they're just all grouped together. They're all the same guy as far as a catcher too. So I'll just play the weekly platoon game.
So if you like Mike Zunino, do you like Gary Sanchez?
I do a little bit. He's not like a must own or anything. He's kind of in that group. But I think I'm higher than most.
I just drafted him. Looking at him some more.
Yeah. It seems like, again, he's got the Zunino mold of shitty average and high home run probabilities, or he has that in him. So it's like, at least I'm getting that. Even if I'm going to have like a crap average, I might as well get something from my catcher.
And that's kind of the discussion. I know people really don't care about catchers that much, but you look at Gary and maybe he hits 215, 220, hopefully, but hits you 25 plus homers, where, you know, like Carson Kelly's hitting 230 with like 13 homers. So like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, the only thing I'm a little bit worried with Gary is, like, obviously they're not going to really play him at DH anymore. And I think Hikitashi or whatever, I think probably steals a little bit more at bats just defensive wise. You know,
he'll catch Cole every fifth day for sure.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think they're going to find out that, like, his defense just keeps going down. It's never been good, but, like, so I think he steals at bats just for that reason alone. So I'm kind of even down on where everybody else is putting his at bats, but, like, I still think he's okay.
Yeah, it's just something I was noticing. Want to get your thoughts on that one. Speaking of the Yankees, DJ LeMahieu, down season last year, and it was weird because, like, I knew he had a down season, but then you look, he still played a ton of games, played over 150 games. So it's like, what happened? And, you know, news has come out now. He had an injury, had surgery, all these things that kind of make you sit back and go, okay, well, that kind of makes a little sense. So assuming he's healthy, leading off for the Yankees seems pretty good still.
Yeah, and the big thing for me, and it's been talked about everywhere, it's just like, he had surgery. It's there. It got fixed. He's got a whole winter. He's a veteran. He knows how to rehab. So to me, like, he's just like how he was. Like, I wasn't a believer of second round LeMahieu, but, you know, I've always thought he was a good, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh rounder. Like, if you go look at his previous seasons, maybe until like 5 or 6 years ago, like, he's going to deliver you a high average, get you runs. The home runs, I'm not necessarily like expecting 25 or 30, but like, he's been a 10 home run, 15 home run guy. And like, he plays every day. So like I think in every single stat category from last year, he's got tremendous upside on everything. And again, it's just recency bias. And I think the problem's gotten taken care of. I really like him. He qualifies at three positions. I'm not a position guy, but I mean, it certainly helps. And it's not like he's getting the multi-positional bump as other guys are.
100%. Yeah, he's one of those guys I've told myself I got to kind of readjust how I'm kind of approaching him, because I've just been off of him in years past. But that's because he was going so high in drafts. Now that price tag's a different animal, and leading off for the Yankees, it's tough to not be productive if you play there majority of the season. So that's definitely one you got to look at. Another guy leading off, or I guess he hit third a couple of times, but he'll hit towards the top of the Jays lineup, which for those keeping track at home, pretty good lineup. And that's George Springer. Obviously, late start to the year because of injuries. When he came back, just torched the baseball. Like, you talk DFS, like that was the automatic. Yeah. Plug him into your lineup, play every single game. Then he got hurt again, and that's just the thing with Springer. You experienced it in Houston, like you've experienced it for a while. Yeah. But he's going to pick 70 right now. So thoughts?
Yeah, again, a guy that I really, really loved. I was in on him last year, and it just sucked that, you know, it just kind of lingered and kind of, you know, lasted way, way longer than everybody expected. You know, yeah, that's been his thing. Is like he's banged up, but again, to me, it's just he's a guy that's going to play every single day. He's like a Justin Turner of the world. Like if he's somewhat healthy, he's going to play every day. He's going to hit on top of the lineup. Like, it's amazing. Like, if you just go look at his game, like when he plays, like he's always doing something. Like, he doesn't put up a lot of 0-fers or whatever. Like, even if he does go 0-for-4, like somehow he gets an RBI that day, or like, you know, it's just, he's always delivering something. I love it. He's always been a run guy. He's always finds ways to score, get on base. Like, you know, the on base percentage is usually pretty good, which I know doesn't really count for anything, but he's got a good base at 265, which is almost above average at this point in major leagues. You know, he's got power, and you know, with the lineup around him batting first, you know, and it turning over, you know, if Toronto's going to stay a good offense in that park, you know, his RBIs are going to be up. Like, they've always been around that 80 mark. You know, like I'm not expecting it to go that much higher because the Astros lineups were just as good, you know, back when he was doing that. But like, it wouldn't surprise me either if it was more. Like, again, he's just always kind of been this undervalued guy that everybody knows is good, but again, is when you get to him, nobody just clicks his name because they like somebody a little bit more or whatever. But for me, like I've just been in love with George Springer ever since Houston. Like, I think this year, like I just knowing his personality. Fun fact, like his parents used to always come out to center field where I hang out. Like, you know, I used to see them every day. Like that I would go. You know, they're just very modest, very like, you know, you can just tell like he was raised right. And so like, again, that doesn't matter at all for fantasy, but like, I just take more of that as work ethic / him wanting to be in the lineup every day. Like, he's just a guy that like, unless he physically can't, like he's going to be there. And I'll just take the chance. Like, to me, it's you're gambling on his injury risk. And that's again, why he's going where he's going. But like, you know, you're going to have to take some type of gambles in any draft you're doing with any type of player. You can only draft safe for so long with so many players. So, like, he's just a guy I'm willing to take a chance on.
Yeah, and there's something you said about work ethic and stuff. There's a lot of things I look at outside the box that if you've played the game or something kind of stands out that'll change a guy. But a couple kind of comparisons where he's getting drafted, just out of curiosity. Would you rather have George Springer or Eloy Jimenez?
You know, I do like Eloy a lot, but I'd still take Springer.
Springer or Castellanos?
Springer, hands down.
All right. Well, we see where you still have those are the two outfielders going right near him. Like, you got Altuve, you got Chisholm, you got Arenado, but those are the outfielders right there. So I want to get your thoughts on those one. Eloy is a fun one, too. That could be another guy that kind of blows up from his draft price as well. So someone to keep an eye on. But this next one is very, very fun because, again, if you played a lot of DFS, you played Michael A. Taylor more than you thought you probably would at times for this Royals team. And if you played in 15-team leagues, you added him in a lot more leagues than you thought you'd ever add him in because he hits ninth. It's not attractive, but he's productive. And you wanted to talk about him because I think it was Rob Silver or someone talking about, you know, 15-15. I was like a 12-14 last year while hitting .244. Projections have him for like 13 to 15 homers, 12-ish stolen bases, which you're getting at his ADP of
like 415.
Yeah, that's Chris Taylor. 400 right now in the month of January. Okay, yeah. 400. Still a pretty good price tag.
Yeah, Jeff Zimmerman hates Michael Taylor, and that and they talk about it on their show like constantly. They both hate him, and like, I agree with them. I don't like him either. He's a horrible actual player. I don't know why they give him at bats, but like, again, like the one thing that's always talked about is like, okay, well, I'm not going to take Edward Olivares because obviously the Royals don't like him, and Yeah. That's why I get sent down. So like, why keep trying to get on that train? Well, it's the same thing with Michael Taylor. Like, they just re-signed him. Why is he still not going to play in center field for another 400 to 500 at bats again? Like, he's going to do the same thing he did last year, which again is, you can argue like he had negative value last year and probably is a negative value player. But again, it's like, I'm not looking to play him for all 400, 500 at bats either. You know, he's more of a pick your spots, like, you know, what series is he going in against what catcher? And like, you know, he's definitely a platoon type hitter for me, but like, that's all he needs to be at his price. And like DC's, he's a free 400, 500 at bats, like, that, you know, is going to play every day.
Yeah. Tremendous. He had 528 at bats last year. That is insane. They get a Michael A. Taylor with that, but yeah, it's in a DC, he's like the perfect late pick. Probably not a draft in a redraft league, but definitely a fab target. If things get bleak in a 15 teamer or something, or you never know, maybe he catches fire even more and there's a step we don't even know about. I doubt it, but you never know. So it is interesting to see him going that late, but it's, you know, you'd start sifting through that later ADP and you're like, wait a minute, why is this guy who plays every single day still down here compared to this guy that's maybe comes up in September? Like, it's an interesting predicament down in the DC streets. But the last guy you have here is a guy I love, and that's Garrett Cooper. I've written about him a couple times. I quote tweeted something from him the other day and he favorited it and I laughed. I'm like, you are board rehabbing, aren't you? But he's swinging in the cage. He's looking healthy. He said he's ready to go. And when this guy is in the lineup, he hits hard. Like, he's really, really good. He's just had some health issues in the past. And this Marlins team is going to be better offensively than people give him credit for. Not world beaters, but better than they give him credit for. So pick 465 right now, Dusty. Like, this is pretty, pretty decent.
Yeah, I think a lot of the Marlins hitters are actually underrated, to be honest. But, like, again, Cooper's kind of like one of those guys I've identified for the NLDH. Like, he just is the perfect NLDH. Like, okay, like, we can just have him hit. He's proven to be a good hitter when he's in the lineup. He does pretty much everything. He gives you some average. Like, you know, his runs and RBIs are usually the same. He usually has a good spot in the lineup. It's just he can't stay on the field. But, like, with the DH, if that gets added, it takes a little bit less injury liability away from him. And again, like, I understand, like, they probably won't make him a permanent DH, but again, if he gives you 350 to 400, 450 at bats, like, all of a sudden he looked really, really attractive down there. What really got me on him, and like, again, if you're not following Craig Mish now for any type of national news / Marlins news specifically, like, you're missing out, but like, he loves Garrett Cooper. Like, and he'll be the first one to tell you, like, yeah, this guy is a flat out good ball player. And it's, you know, like, it shows up. It's just, he never plays. And again, that's why he's down here. But again, why not gamble on playing time, especially at this price?
Yeah. I'm a huge Cooper fan. He's a guy I know that, in redraft leagues, I'm not going to say I'm going to draft him right now, but 100% will be on that first watch list. Like, he's going to be a guy that the second there's buzz about playing time, or he's one of those we talked about at the beginning of the show, like, look ahead a few weeks and they have a bunch of lefties on the agenda or something. Like, this is a guy to get to, because he can hit righties just fine too, but like, he'll mash you a lefty. So I love Garrett Cooper, and he's a very, very, like, he's one of those guys that for some reason something happened to like Aguilar or something, like, he could just walk in. And besides the DH thing, which I completely agree with, but definitely a guy to keep on the radar. That I think he's another one, though, once people see him in, like, spring training, he might move up a little bit. Not a ton, because it's still, you know, a bench bat, but I think people start realizing he's healthy, and let's pay attention a little more. So, with you on that. Let's get to a couple listener questions here. At Matthew Fryer asks, do you favor Chaz McCormick, Jose Siri, and Jake Meyer, let's say DC mode? Who do you favor? You said you like Jake Myers, but if you had to pick one, is that the guy you're going with?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Jake Meyers if I got to pick one.
Okay. Your good buddy, Phil Dussault. I don't know the robe story, but I'm going to let that go. He said, I'd like to know if Dusty is currently lying down on his couch in a bathrobe. I've never seen him in any other position. Well, Phil, you can watch, and no, he's not. But he said, last year you made a controversial decision when you dropped Edwin Diaz. How did that work out in hindsight? Was it the right move? Jenny Butler was also curious about this.
Yeah, so the robe story really quick is just in our $2,500 DC MTM draft that we did, we you know, and I don't think, was it? Yeah, it was last year. It was in March. We were all on a Zoom call, and it was like late at night. Everybody's talking, whatever. Like, I'm tired as all get out. I'm just sitting, laying down, just listening to the chat, or and everybody just, you know, BSing. And Phil's just kind of like, yeah, I guess you're comfortable right there. And I was just like, look, man, like, I don't care at this point. Like, it's just, it's fine. So that's kind of like the Rome story, awesome. Whatever. But yeah, as far as that, you know, it's funny. I read, I think Todd Whitestone does a little article of drops or whatever. And he kind of mentioned it. And again, like he doesn't know as far as like team context or whatever, but basically, I drafted Diaz and Jordan Hicks, I think, in the 10th round. And, you know, Jordan Hicks, just that was it, like, early on. So now I'm down to Diaz. And I think I'd already spent, like, a couple $100 in Fab early on. So it was like, okay, am I going to really try to put $200 to $400 chasing saves in Fab the rest of the year where I may or may not get any type of save help versus just punting saves? And like, if I'm going to punt saves, like, there's no reason to keep Diaz because every single team has 1.5 to 2 closers. And again, like, this is May and I already know, like, the team concept, my team was really good enough looking at it. I knew it was not an overall winner. It really would have needed a ton of help, saves wise. So I do this even controversially, even in drafts. Like, I'll just sit there in the middle of a draft and say, you know what? I don't really like this team. I don't think it's an overall winner. I'm going to change it up and just go for the league, even sometimes mid-draft, which I know, like, yeah, you're giving up equity because overall contests take a lot of these monies out. But, like, that's just kind of my thought process for it.
Money's money.
Yeah, exactly. So going back to this, you know, I just made the conscientious decision. Like, I could gain in strikeouts and wins. Especially if I made this decision early, my ERA and WHIP were already like pretty much dog crap. So like there was no risk of even streaming like crap two start pitchers. It was just, I just need volume. Any type of good volume is even better, but I just need volume to gain in wins and strikeouts. My offense, which was pretty much top of the league, was going to carry me. At the time in May, I think I was in like 6th or 7th with like, you know, high 80s. And I knew like I just didn't have a chance if I was going to stay stagnant. So by dropping him, and it allowed me to play that volume game. I ended up placing 2nd, I think, in the league with 112 points. But again, it's like those are the types of decisions I think you gain with experience. And like, yeah, it's hard giving up on a overall in May. And like, yeah, I could have easily found the saves and then maybe won the league. But like, it was just one of those, like, especially knowing experience and trying to know that they're going to hold up roster spots and just looking at the team, I just didn't see the path for it. And looking back, like, even if I would have kept Diaz, I would have gained 1 point, but then I would have lost around like 10 or 11 points in wins and strikeouts just by doing that. Because again, like, I know that sounds like a lot of points in there, but you have to remember I'm just literally putting volume in that 9th spot instead of a reliever that's going to pitch 3 innings at max in a week.
I'm glad Phil asked this question because that's a great discussion point. I had Zach Waxman on a few weeks ago, and we talked about like the 80th percentile in leagues. Like, but someone asked that was new to DCs, is it cool to punt a position? And he basically said, if, because the guy said, I'm new and I want to win the league, like the overall would be great, but I want to just like build my bankroll type deal, but still learn how to play in the format. So it's yin and yang. So Zach, he looked at the numbers you need just to win your league if you punted saves over like the 80th percentile leagues. And it wasn't as much as you think. And you, if you just like where you would have taken saves, guys, go and take another big bat or do this or that, you can jump stuff like crazy. Yeah,
I mean,
it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, it's a viable strategy because, like, if it wasn't, people wouldn't do it in the higher stakes standalone league, right? And where you can get a little bit more value. I know everybody loves that word.
Yeah.
In an overall competition, teams don't do that. So, like, you're in an advantage league wise when you punt something because everybody else is still playing for the overall, whether they think they are or not, even the teams that probably shouldn't still be playing for the overall are still playing for the overall. You gain an advantage with either roster flexibility or like you, like let's just say you went into a main event just like, okay, I'm not going to go for an overall, which I don't think is the play, by the way. I would just join the standalone league. But at some point, you can make a decision, like I said, in the middle of a draft, like, you know what? This draft just didn't fall my way for closers or whatever. Like, I don't really like these guys. Rather than taking them, I'm just going to go a route that I'm giving up on the overall, which, again, that's just like everybody can draft their own team and make their own decisions. And if you're willing to give up that equity, like, you can give up that equity.
But it's a great point you just made there is on those higher stakes ones, like the $1,000 DCs and these other ones you see, Phil's even admitted it. And so there's, so are these other guys that I would not draft so-and-so in those leagues. I'm like more of a safe, I get this, this, and this. Where in like the 150s, they're like, they're shooting for the moon. And it's a totally different strategy, like you said. So it's a great point. And I think people need to decide what you do. The standalone thing is like, I play a ton of satellites. I told people like a year ago that said the NFBC is too expensive and this and that, where it's pricey. There's no hiding that at all. But I showed them there's ways to build your bankroll. Like I won an OC qualifier last year for $50. Like there's ways you can do it to make it. So I'm trying to like show them examples of like, go build your money here, dump it over here, kind of play the game. And next thing, like Modica talks about it. He started out with next to nothing. He's built it up and look what he does now. Like, I guarantee most people don't just walk in and be like, okay, I'm going to play in these three and spend like 10 grand or whatever. Like, that's just not the way it works. So more often than not, at least, but there's ways to do it. And I think the standalone draft mindset's interesting because most people frown upon punting, but it's feasible.
Yeah. So. I mean, there's plenty of I know we're running long anyways, but like there's plenty of strategies, especially if you're just trying to build a bankroll where like you can just punt starting pitching and just take relief pitchers and just play the innings game, the innings limit game, where you're going to win ERA, whip and saves, and but you're punting strikeouts and wins, but it allows you to basically take hitters all 10 rounds or whatever, however you're going to do it. I mean, it's not that easy, but just trying to dumb it down a little bit. But like there's strategies out there. If you're just trying to build a bankroll, like, yeah, you may give up first, but like you're giving yourself a good chance for second or third in league if they do have those types of prizes.
Yep, definitely. Two more questions. You mentioned Vogel. Brian Vogel asked, who was a bigger crush on Kyle Tucker, me or Dusty?
Yeah. I think it's you. Yeah, I do have him as my profile pick on Twitter, so like maybe that's why I win, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, it's fair. And then Vlad Sedler, we talked about earlier, and I kind of mentioned it, but he's I don't know if he's trolling or curious. Am I wasting my 49th round DC pick on Pete Solomon?
I think he's pretty serious, honestly. Like I'm fine with him. I think he's going to be like that 7th, 8th starter. Like he'll get some spot starts, especially 49th. It's like whatever. Like he's going to be up at some point, either as like a middle reliever or like that spot starter type guy. But like, you know, I'm talking about 50 innings, but like when you're in 49th round of the DC, you're just looking for somebody that's going to play this year. I think he's fine. Like he's not going to be anything special. I don't think I'm not a huge prospect guy, but I think he's good enough where like you could use him a week or two during a season.
There you go, Vlad. You got the Dusty Astro seal of approval on that one. So enjoy it. But we're going to wrap it up there. It's been awesome chatting with you on this one. Any final thoughts as we almost are into February, assuming the season starts on time? Any final thoughts on the upcoming draft season?
Yeah, keep drafting closers early.
I love it. And it makes sense. Like I see both sides of the spectrum. I get both angles. As much as I've drafted early, I'm starting to lean. I'm almost maybe starting to turn more your direction now, but I'm still not 100% there just yet. But Fab Leagues, I probably will be. So that's for sure. But like I said, we'll wrap it up right there. Make sure you guys all follow Dusty on Twitter at Wagner13454. And Dusty, thanks for joining me, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Bubba, for having me.
Everybody, this is Bench with Bubba, episode 433 with Dusty Wagner. Catch you guys later.
Life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance, because you'll feel protected no matter how the wind blows. Also, you can keep enjoying the home of your dreams. And our expert agents can help you save up to 23% when you bundle home with auto. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.